Okay, well, so I'm going to start my very basic introduction to ADS-CFT in second version. This is what I plan on talking about. It's kind of short-ish, although I don't know how long it'll take. But if I go under, then Sean has promised to do some Mathematica demonstrations or something like that. I wanted to talk about sort of some of the kinematics of the duality. So talk about how operators in the field theory map onto the fields in the bulk, and especially how you might use them to start deforming away from the standard examples, for example, n equals 4, Young Mills. And then I want to talk about this really nice simple model of confinement in ADS-CFT, which is due to Witten, which is, you know, very basic, but it allows you to understand how confinement works in ADS-CFT. And it's an important example because ADS-CFT is very nice in that it allows sort of very complicated things like confinement to have a nice geometric duality. And so this is a basic example of that. All right, so let me start in ADS. So here's the standard picture of ADS. I'll work in sort of general dimensions. So this is going to be dual to CFT in D dimensions. So this is space-time dimensions in the boundary, and then there's one extra dimension in the bulk. So in particular, you'll notice that there were other factors here, some spheres or whatever. I'm going to strip away the complications of this for now, for this discussion. So this is sort of where most of the action is happening. So let's just focus on this space. So how I'm drawing it, there's T and X directions which go this way, and then there's a radial direction. And the metric that I'll use is as follows. So you've seen this a million times now. So these are the field theory directions. And R is the radial direction. In particular, in this metric, R goes to infinity is here in this picture, and there's a boundary there. And R goes to zero is down here. And there's a horizon in ADS in this coordinate system, which is a little like a black hole horizon. The isometries of ADS. Map onto just the conformal group. So ADS D plus 1 map onto the conformal group in D dimensions. In particular, the most important one is the scaling. So you can see that the following leaves the metric invariant. If I scale time, space, and the radial direction inversely, so lambda is my scaling parameter, then this metric is left invariant. So that's an isometry, and that obviously maps onto just the scaling in the conformal theory. There's a basic sort of element of the dictionary which maps fields in the bulk. So I'll use bulk to mean here, and sometimes I'll call the boundary is sort of the field theory. So fields in the bulk versus operators on the boundary, which is really just the field theory. For example, if I had a scalar field, it propagates xt in the radial direction. Then that somehow maps onto an operator in the boundary, which just says x and t. And actually, I told you last time about how typically with these dualities, for n equals 4, it's defined in terms of a matrix theory, and it turns out that the operators, the fields in the bulk correspond to operators in the boundary, which are single trace operators. So these M's are like field strengths or scalars or fermions that are all in the adjoint of SUN. So they're matrices. So I can form traces out of them, which are gauge invariant, and it, bulk, fields in the bulk map to single trace operators. good. So to sort of get an idea of how this works, we can just sort of study a really simple scalar field in ADS. I just write down the Klein-Gordon equation. I can write down more complicated things, but this is the simplest example, and try to solve it. I get some idea by going to the boundary, so R goes to infinity. In this limit, I can ignore the time derivatives and the spatial derivatives because they all come with factor of one over R squared. So these go away. And I'm just left with the radial derivatives where I get some factor. Plus one, and then the mass. And you see that this is sort of scale invariant in the sense that the number of R's that appear here in this term is zero. There's two derivatives, and then this two powers of R from here. So that means you can guess that the solutions to this equation are just power laws. In fact, there are two power laws. With sort of two integration constants. So this is as high as infinity. This is sort of a very important equation. There are two terms here which I'm going to dissect over the next few minutes. In particular, to have a well-defined theory on this space-time, because there's a boundary, as you're used to, you should impose some kind of boundary condition at infinity. And yeah, I forgot to tell you, this delta. I mean, if you just sort of plug in scale invariant solutions, you figure out what delta is in terms of m squared. So L is the ADS radius. I think I used L as the ADS radius before. So delta will turn out to be the conformal dimension of this operator. So it has some delta, and that maps to the mass through this formula. So I was saying, to have a well-defined problem, you should impose some kind of boundary condition here. And the most natural one is just, this is the biggest term here. You see delta is always bigger than d over 2 in this formula, so this is always much bigger than this. So it's just natural to impose a boundary condition that this should vanish. So that's a natural boundary condition. And then beta here is just free. It's beta. Is determined by sort of what's going on in the bulk. So it's actually determined by the state of the theory. So all sorts of crazy things could be going on in the bulk. I could be forming a black hole. And during that process, I'll impose this boundary condition. And then I can read off beta, and that tells me something about the formation of that black hole. In particular, beta maps to the VEV of this operator that it's dual to in that state that you're looking at. So this part of the dictionary, which I'll sort of explain how you get later. With this, you know, you can read off the value of O, given that alpha is zero, just by multiplying by powers of R, R to the delta times phi of X, comma R. So I think I might use X to mean X and T. Sort of relativistic, if that's okay. So this is R goes to infinity. So from this, you know, we can scale, do our bulk isometry, where we scale x by lambda, t by lambda, and then r by inverse lambda. And also under this bulk isometry, this field just goes to the same thing. So there's no scaling for phi. If you plug this scaling isometry into here, you can show the following equation for O of X maps to O prime of X prime, which is some lambda to the minus delta O of X. So we see that O, the operator O, has scaling dimension delta. Of course, we could have just figured that out from this formula, because beta here, R has units of energy, right? Because X has units of length, and R is the inverse of that. So beta obviously has to have units of energy to the delta. So that's good. We can go a little bit further than this. Now we can sort of deform away from the theory that we're working with, and to do that you turn on alpha. So previously, you know, you could fix this, or to deform the theory. So, deform theory. You might impose some boundary condition like this, where J is fixed. It's something that you put in by hand. And the idea is that sort of corresponds to taking the CFT, or more generally field theory, and deforming it by that. And this sort of leads to one sort of defining relation for the ADS CFT correspondence, which is the statement that if I sort of define some bulk partition function for the gravity, so here I'm just sort of working in the classical limit, where, you know, I don't have strings, you can think of this as some sort of bulk path integral over the metric and the fields and any other field. So this is the field that I'm thinking about here, where we impose particular boundary conditions at the boundary. So then e to the minus the gravitational action. And for example, so the boundary condition we want to impose here is that phi goes to this alpha r to the delta minus d, where alpha is fixed in terms of j, equal to this j. So we do the path integral with this boundary condition, and the idea is that that's equal to the partition function of the field theory, which is just in the presence of this deformation. And I guess I'm thinking of working in Euclidean right now. You can easily sort of generalize it to real space. So where j and alpha are identified here. So given this, you can sort of differentiate both sides with respect to J, and this will tell you, if you sort of carefully do this, much more carefully than what I'm stating here, you find that the verb of this operator here is equal to beta, after some numbers. Okay, so those are the two important things, the verb there and the source here. Okay, does everyone understand? Very basic. This is useful, you know, this is often used in this ADS-CNT program in the form of linear response theory, which I'm only going to spend a few minutes on, because I think you've probably heard a lot about it. So a useful quantity in linear response is a retarded Green function, which you can define. It only exists retarded, so it's only non-zero for t is bigger than zero. And then you define it in terms of the commutator of the field. And so, you know, this is something you might want to compute. It tells you a lot about the response of the theory to various sources. So the way you do this in ADS-CFT, is simply, you know, you study linearized fluctuations, fluctuations in the bulk. So, for example, the Klein-Gordon equation for phi. Then you impose some boundary condition in the bulk. So, for example, typically there's some kind of a horizon. It might be a finite temperature horizon. It might be something else, where things sort of can fall through. And basically, you want to impose a condition that things fall in and not out. So this is the same, this will be the same as this sort of the fact that we're computing a retarded Green function. So for example, at the horizon of ADS, which kind of erased the metric, but as r goes to zero, this field behaves as follows. In Fourier components, so omega k, r, this goes up to some normalization e to the minus squared plus I epsilon plus k squared 1/2 over r. Okay, so this is the ingoing boundary condition, and basically you see this omega plus I epsilon squared. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't have to follow the Klein-Gordon equation.
So you're just taking an example right now.
Yeah.
I have another question. When you first look at the Klein-Gordon equation,
yeah,
you ignore the ddl squared term, ddt squared term,
yeah,
the dx squared term,
yeah,
because it's at r to infinity.
That's right, yeah.
But once you go back to the bulk, you have to put those.
That's right. And that was important to get this. I'm studying the same equation.
Does that determine beta or beta's given to you?
Yeah, so that's what I'm going to discuss now. So,
trying to determine beta now. Is that right?
Yeah. There is some confusion here, which I'll hopefully try to... for example, in this example that I wrote down, once I impose this boundary condition, we're in ADS. Mm-hmm. So if we work in the vacuum of ADS, mm-hmm, that necessarily implies that beta is zero, because it has scaling dimensions, so that would break the conformal symmetry if it was non-zero.
Again, alpha and beta both zero? No.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
In the vacuum of ADS, in the conformal vacuum. So to have beta not zero, you have to have something happening in the bulk. And then what?
You mean non-vacuum?
Yeah.
You mean that you have to have some excitations around?
Right? Yeah, that's right. And then those excitations will determine for you what beta is. This is slightly different because this is sort of a linear response problem, so I'm explicitly putting a source in, right? And so both alpha and beta are not going to be zero. So we have some ingoing boundary condition. As r goes to zero, obviously this form no longer works because the k squared and the omega squared terms are important. The dt squared and the dx squared terms are important. And that's when you get something like this. And you see the I epsilon here is going to tell you how to take this branch cut, to take this square root. And that's what's going to give you the appropriate ingoing boundary conditions. And you'll notice that it's sort of the same thing as continuing from the Euclidean to find the tidal Green's function. And that's not a coincidence. So you impose that boundary condition as r goes to zero, and then r goes to infinity, you find this sort of form, except now in Fourier space, so phi k alpha. So from this, you can read off the Green's function, because you know the Green's function works something like this. The retarded Green's function tells you how the operator responds in frequency space to a source. So that tells me that GR is just the ratio of these two, O over J, did I get this right? Yes. Over J. Which in terms of alpha and beta is just beta k and omega over alpha k and omega. This is a very quick way to get the two-point function. So just to emphasize that, the wave function that's used to compute this does not actually live in the state of this theory. It's because we're, perturbing the theory a little bit.
So how do you know alpha and beta?
Sorry. How do you know alpha and beta?
Yeah.
So you have one boundary condition in the interior, right, up to normalization. So that will determine, because it's a linear equation, it will determine this up to normalization, right? But we only care about the ratio, so the normalization doesn't matter.
But you need to install both null and R infinity and R zero both linear information. So where did you use both of them?
This is sort of a problem in a, this is a, this I'm solving a differential equation to go from here to here, right? So I'm solving the Klein-Gordon equation, and it turns out to be Bessel functions, right? And Bessel functions have this kind of behavior as r goes to zero and as r goes to infinity, so that tells you what these things are. Okay. I should also say the answer, which is sort of fixed in terms of conformal invariance, which is delta.
How do I know that the alpha is equal to J? Is that a statement from string theory?
If
somebody gives you this, how would you know that alpha is?
How would I know that alpha is?
So that's part of the dictionary that you have to know.
Part of the dictionary, you need to know which fields map onto which operators. Uh-huh. But you can sort of, there are ones that where it's obvious, like the stress tensor couples to the metric on the boundary.
Do you something you can do while preserving the environment information. So it's not, it can't be a fine mechanism change.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's getting happy.
The master McGreevy what the truth is.
Well, Thomas telling you the truth. I was just saying, you can see just from thinking about fields and end of sitter space, the burying alpha is not something that can be done at finite energy. It's not something you can do just without your environmental damage to the system. So it's it's not just changing the state of the system described, it's changing the system. So like adding a source.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't really understand this state. What's the state of theory? What is that?
Yeah, so one nice state would be the ground state. That's typically, you have to look for the minimum energy state or something like that. But you could also consider excited states, right? So you could, just consider ADS with some lump of stuff inside of it, right? And then see how it evolves in time. And as long as, you're imposing this boundary condition while you do that, then this can be anything, really.
That's the minimum energy state of what Hamiltonian?
Of this, it depends. It depends on your action in the bulk. So you have some gravity and...
So it's gravity plus all these other people.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have to carefully define what you mean by energy in ADS.
I think the thing that confuses me about the word state is because the boundary theory is a conformal field theory, right? If it's not a normal field theory, like QCD or something at this point.
That's just a special type of field theory, yeah.
Yeah, it's a conformal field theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, for example, I could give you some state if it's a QCD. Some experimentalists could come in and give you a state. I want a state with 3 protons and 5 gluons around or something. And how would you calculate this? See, you don't actually, because it's a conformal field theory, the states are very limited. Is that right?
No, I mean, you don't have to retain conformal invariants, so you can have anything.
It's true that you wouldn't describe the excited states in terms of particles.
Right.
Yeah. No particles. But you could describe a state which is, 3 excitations of this scaling operator and 7 excitations of this scaling operator.
I see. Yeah, a state in which you hit the ground state with so many operators.
Ah.
Yeah. So that's, I guess that's what I meant. So it's hard to think of the actual what that state means. I can't quite picture.
Is this state classical or quantum?
It's quantum.
Just the function, how do you define superposition of states?
So we're definitely taking some kind of a classical limit here, but in principle it's quantum. So the G Newton goes to zero limit is like a classical limit.
Can we do something a little bit beyond that and consider superposition?
What
would that be? Would there be superpositions of different betas or something?
Superpositions of different what?
Betas.
Betas? That's the operator, right? This is the beta of the operator.
Oh,
operator. So, yeah, I don't really...
If you worked in the Lorentzian signature, you would just introduce a state, and you wanted to work in this path integral formalism, and then you would introduce a state.
Sure.
Stick away from it and then determine.
That's right. Yeah.
Path and a goal at some.
Yeah, yeah.
Initial time.
Sure. And yeah. So.
Not, not since it's.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. So you would, yeah, so you would take ADS, yeah, that's a good point, yeah, and then pick some slice, right, and then you would define your fields on that slice, and then, you know, you would integrate over those fields in sort of a path interval. and so, yeah, that's, yeah. yes. I mean, it's just it is sort of ultimately quantum field theory in the bulk, so it's quantum mechanics.
Can I ask perhaps a related question? So this is a finite temperature black hole in general. You've told us how to get the response function, but we might be interested in the fluctuations in the in O on the boundary. How does one get that out except at the end here using an ad hoc application of fluctuation dissipation?
Sorry, what's the question?
Well, you've got the two-point correlator, the retarded Green's function for this operator.
Yeah.
We might be interested in its thermal fluctuation, fluctuations, for example.
Sure, yeah, there's a whole story about that, which I'm not that familiar with. But yeah, you can define. So in equilibrium, you can define all the different Green's functions in real time, and you can show that there's the fluctuation dissipation theorem works. And yeah.
I mean, this is related to what this state is, I guess. You're doing your average.
Yeah. So that in particular, that discussion applies to a black hole, something called an eternal black hole, where you know you can, yeah. You can make these statements precise, but I haven't really discussed black holes yet. That's why this is so simple. Seems to be some confusion about.
So. I was coming pretty much as a picture of whether you're talking to say, you don't have to be in a field value state; you could be in any state. You can just put in any functional
phi
that you want on
that
slide.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Temperature,
yeah, this is zero temperature.
Okay. But it's easily generalizable to
Yeah. I wasn't really interested in that, but you can put a black hole in and then it's easy. Generalizable. But then obviously you're not working in a pure state. But it allows for that, yeah. All right. So now I want to talk a bit more about rather than a linear response, some like larger deformations. So linear response.
Can I ask a general question just to help me understand what's going on? There are a lot of equal signs on the blackboard, right? But there's only one equal sign that you need string theory for. Is that right? The Z gravity equals ZF field theory. That equal sign you need string theory for. Everything else could be derived just using field theory. Is that right?
Yeah.
The other equal signs. Once you've given that equal sign, then everything else follows.
Sure. Yeah. But we're not really given that.
Yeah. But right. That equal sign you
so
need,
just
you need
conjecture.
String theory, right?
Well,
what do you need string theory for?
So this is the, you know, you could say that this is the conjecture, right? That's not proven.
Okay. Motivated by string theory.
Yes, but motivated by string theory.
That's but once you're given that equal sign, everything else
Yeah, it's roughly. I mean, this is not the best, because you know it's some gravity partition function. So, really, the conjecture is the statement that the Hilbert spaces are the same on the two sides.
But I just want to know if everything could be derived from that inequality, or whether you make another conjecture here, or another guess here, and there.
No. Yeah, I think most things can come.
And be followed on that. Okay. Good.
One thing that might help is that here it looks kind of like there's a little more than just that equal sign. We have to specify boundary conditions at the horizon of a black hole, that sort of thing. That all does actually follow from the first equal sign.
Right.
But there's a whole song and dance about going to Lorentzian signature and going through Schwinger-Keldysh carefully.
Yeah.
But if you do that,
there's
just the one equal sign.
Yeah, one equal sign, there's song and plus song and dance, and everything follows.
Yeah, sure.
So that's what I want to know.
Yeah, sure. All right, so let's go beyond linear response. So let's talk about big deformations. Okay, so if I just stare at this equation, I impose alpha is not zero. Just say it doesn't depend on x or t. So I'm just adding a source. I'm just adding alpha, which is a constant O, to the theory. Okay. So now, what do you expect to happen from the field theory side? Depends on whether this operator is relevant or irrelevant. So let's start with irrelevant, where the dimension of the operator is bigger than D, which is the space-time dimensionality of the field theory. So you see, if you're adding something irrelevant to a field theory, you expect the UV to not be well-defined in the field theory. And so that's exactly what happens here. If delta is bigger than D, then as r goes to infinity, phi blows up, right? So when phi blows up, you can no longer sort of trust the linearized approximation that we started with. In particular, it's going to back react on gravity, and it will destroy the ADS asymptotics, and it's sort of a bad thing, okay? So destroy these ADS. But this is exactly what we expect. So relevant, delta is less than D, then you know this is good. You add a relevant deformation, and in the IR you expect something to happen at some scale. So again, from this formula, if delta is less than D, as R goes to zero, phi blows up. Okay. So phi blows up. It only blows up when this sort of linearized analysis is correct. Something else is going to happen, so that's sort of the question that you can ask depending on the theory. So you know, you have this picture of ADS, the ADS boundary, and on top of this I'll draw a picture of phi as a function of r. So in this case, you know, it starts zero at the boundary and then becomes large. And at some point, say, you know, when it gets order one in some units, then something has to happen, okay? So this defines some scale, which just from dimensional analysis is alpha to the power 1 over d minus delta, where you're gonna flow to something else. There's a few sort of possibilities. One is that you flow to another CFT. That's a natural thing that can happen. Or another thing that you might expect is a gap to develop. So I'll go through these two examples. Yeah.
Isn't there a type of possibility that you wonder what happens? Or is that
yeah, that's certainly a possibility. Well, yeah, no, quite often you don't know what happens. Well, it depends which framework you're working, but yeah.
Like you're running with those 5G.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are, So the first example can sort of easily be constructed if I just take a scalar field, so the bulk action. Kinetic term, but then I add a potential, right, to the scalar, so this can have interactions and that doesn't have to be quadratic. So this isn't a bulk. And then I imagine a potential which looks like this. So firstly, V of 0, let me define that to be as follows, L squared. So I should, this is really gravity plus the scalar field, so the theory of gravity plus the scalar field. And then the potential when the field is 0 is negative, right? So this is sort of the negative CC that's required to give you ADS. Right, and it's going to be ADS with a curvature scale of L. That's those numbers are there, so that this gives you the right curvature radius. It's M squared locally is less than 0. Okay, but actually that's okay in ADS, as long as M squared times this L squared here is bigger than minus d over 2 squared. This is the BF bound, and it just allows scalar fields to be slightly tachyonic in ADS and for there to be no instability. So we can have a theory where phi is just 0 sitting there completely stable. Nothing will happen. But then something can happen if I push it, by hand I push it off. Okay, and of course the way to do this is to impose that phi goes like this at the boundary. Okay? So it's non-zero. And that will effectively push the field off here. And as you can imagine, the field's going to roll down and end up here. In particular, there is another stable solution in this theory where just phi is phi naught right here. And V of phi naught, I'm going to define to be minus d minus 1 over L twiddle squared. Then this solution, written in terms of L twiddle, is just going to correspond to ADS d plus 1 with curvature scale L twiddle. Okay, so there's a different CC, so the size of the ADS will be different. Okay, so there are these two solutions, and of course it's natural that there's some kind of flow that interpolates between them. So if I write the metric as follows.
So the phi is going to find out at what value of R?
At all values of R. Okay, so this is just so I'll write the metric and then I'll explain these two solutions. So let's just take the metric to be of this sort of more general form. Okay. So remember that when we're in ADS, this f of r was just constant. That was L squared. Okay. So there's one solution. So phi is phi of r. This is one solution. This is another solution. This is for all r. F of r is L twiddle squared, phi is phi naught. Okay.
I have another confusion. What happened to beta? Did you set beta equal to zero?
Okay, so beta appears dynamically. Okay, so right now actually I've set alpha to zero. I'm just looking at these two fixed points. Uh-huh. Now when I turn on alpha, I can have a flow between these two. So basically now I can have a picture, another solution, as a function of, say, log r, if I plot f of r, then f of r is going to look something like this. All right, so it's going to go between L twiddle squared and L squared. So this is r goes to infinity. And we know as r goes to infinity, we have to get back to this original fixed point because this is vanishing as r goes to infinity. And so not only do we have f of r that looks like this, we have the field phi doing something like this, so phi of r. Right, so it ends up phi naught, and it started at zero. Okay. And then this crossover scale is exactly the scale that I mentioned before. It's just alpha, the 1 over d minus delta. Okay? Right. So this is a flow from ADS to this ADS twiddle. Right.
So the metric you wrote down up there is a solution of Einstein's equation sourced by some scalar field by this.
That's right, yeah. So if I take this and I vary it with respect to metric and the scalar field, I plug these in, it'll solve it if, you might have to solve this numerically, but this is what the profile does. So for example, you can take this and read off beta from this solution. So beta is this subleading component, but it's there. In particular, just from looking at this potential, you'll notice that, the minimum of the potential which determines L twiddle, it has to be bigger than this, at least the modulus, so L twiddle squared has to be less than L squared. I think I used that when I drew this picture, maybe. And then if you remember from last lecture, the central charge, let's say that we're working in even dimension boundary, the central charge of one of these CFT fixed points is just given by the ADS curvature radius, the d minus 1 over g Newton. And so c twiddle is the same thing, but with L twiddle in it. And you notice that this implies that c twiddle is less than c. Right? So the central charge is decreased, so there's some kind of a C theorem. In fact, you can establish this much more rigorously based on a null energy condition in the bulk. Switch chalk. Does anyone have questions about this?
Isn't the first CFT over CFT?
What do you mean first? Yeah, this is one. Yeah. Two is a, I'm not going to have much to say about two.
So is the CFT still n equal to 4 mLs?
No. Oh. No. Yeah. So I think there are some. These flows do exist. I just wrote down some random bulk potential, but you can look at the real examples, and there are these flows. I think sometimes you have some idea what the CFT is that it ends up, but quite often you don't. You just know there's some CFT. It might have some random conformal dimensions, which you know, there's no way to explain. So yeah, so now how might we get a mass gap? Yeah.
So in most of the CFT, you said there are always very small number of things which have small dimension and everything else is very dark. So how do I see here that even after doing some other CFT that holds?
Oh yeah, it's just it's a statement about the ADS radius in terms of the string scale. Right, so it has to be much bigger than the string scale for things to make sense. So I guess you could imagine one where this becomes very small, in which case then you'll lose control. But yeah, no, it, you know, these are all numbers of order one. So
L can be zero or close to zero or some.
Well, I mean, then you'll lose control. So. It seems like you also the central charge also decreases. It might decrease so much that you also lose control. Well, no, sorry. You're just going to lose control of the stream. So of the locality.
A sort of naive understanding. Central charge measures the degrees of freedom.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So you're losing degrees of freedom.
That's right.
Where do they go?
Oh. I mean, I don't know. I don't have a good picture of what these CFTs are. I mean, it's just nice that this fact came out of some random gravity thing, the null energy condition.
Uh-huh.
There are simple examples where you can understand it, like if you have a mass term for
some of the
fields.
So some of them get mass and.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, those are the examples probably where you have control over what that CFT is in the end. Yeah.
What are some examples in which you have control?
I think one of the deformations of n equals 4 to n equals 2 you can control.
Yeah.
You know about this?
Yeah, I should know.
Yes, we should know.
Right. N equals 4 to
n equals 2.
N equals to 1 fixed point in the infrared, so deformation by a mass to chiral multiple, like one of the chiral superfields gets a mass, and it goes to a fixed point, and everything can be computed exactly.
And you know what that fixed point is?
Yeah.
There's some supersymmetry methods to understand the action. But there are also examples where you get things with conformal dimensions of root 7, and like there's another.
These examples actually have masses below the BF bound. A lot of these examples are non-BPS, so that's actually kind of confusing because we get when you don't have supersymmetry to protect you, you generally get masses below.
Sure,
the BF.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's kind of unclear what happens.
Okay. So now, how might you get a mass gap? So this is a little bit complicated. So remember, I think people have said this, you kind of need ADS to end at some radius. So at this scale, lambda, where it's going to cross over, you want things, there to be a mass gap. So remember that, the radial directions maps onto energy, and so you need somehow the space to end. So it's kind of hard to do this in this d plus one dimensional point of view. Really, you need to go back to string theory, or at least supergravity in 10 dimensions to understand examples like this. But one sort of rough way you can understand what's going on is this scalar field, which is blowing up, actually does blow up and causes a singularity in the bulk. And as long as this singularity is some nice kind of singularity, then you might be able to understand that in terms of a theory with a mass gap. But the best way to understand this is to go to 10D, in which case this singularity that appears is usually resolved by some stringy thing, like a D-brain. So I don't really have that much to say about this. So for example, you can take n equals 4 super n mils, deform it to this thing called n equals 1 star, where you basically you're adding mass terms for a lot of the extra matter fields in the n equals 4 superhitting nulls, and you're breaking some of the supersymmetries. And you know that in this theory, you expect there to be a confining vacuum, and you can show that in AES CFT that sort of corresponds to this singularity being sourced by an NS5 brain in 10 dimensions. Yeah. This is the Polchinski Strassler solution. But if I have time, people will let me. There's a much simpler model for confinement, which doesn't have all of these crazy things. Sorry, a simple model. So the example I'm going to work out is in 2+1 dimensions. And basically the idea is to take n equals 4. So this is written n equals 4 superhitting nulls and put it on a circle. A circle in one direction, so really on a cylinder. So we have the x3 direction, x1, x2, right, so with some radius scale. If I impose anti-periodic boundary conditions on the fermions, which I'm allowed to do, the choice, I could impose periodic boundary conditions, so psi of x.
X3 is a time,
which is time. Oh, no. So X3 is just one of the spatial coordinates. So there's T as well. So T is not. T is.
But it's through the conduction. So you have only.
Yeah, so this. I'm starting with 3+1 dimensional theory, and I'm going to compactify it down to 2+1 dimensions. Right. So this is 2+1. But you know, the bosons have periodic boundary conditions, so x. So this sort of this explicitly breaks supersymmetry. In particular, this guy, because of this sort of anti-periodic periodicity, means that the fermions have a mass which is like 1 over R3. Just by this sort of KK reduction. The bosons don't get that mass, but at one loop, it's expected that they will. Some diagram like this, where the fermions are running in the loop, and then the mass of x squared is equal to something like G angle squared NC, which is the Tuft coupling, which is 1 over R3 squared. Good. That means that the fermions and the bosons have got a mass. So basically, all I'm left with is pure Yang-Mills theory in 2+1 dimensions. So the energy scale is much less than. So I'm kind of working perturbatively in small coupling right now, just because that's what we understand field theory. So at energy is much smaller than this compactification radius, we go to a 2+1 dimensional pure Yang-Mills theory. In particular, you know, it's a 2+1 dimensional theory, so the effective coupling grows large. It depends on the energy scale that you're probing the theory. So in terms of the 4-dimensional Lotov's coupling, the reduction on R3 gives you this, makes it gives the coupling dimensions, and then as a function of energy, it goes like 1 over energy, blows up, as the energy goes to 0. So you know you can have a picture of the sort of the effective coupling at a given scale. And you know above 1 over R3, it's actually conformal theory, so the coupling is just constant. And below this, it starts diverging. And then something happens, you know. Maybe when this becomes of order 1, maybe you expect some confinement. So lambda, so this is when this is of order 1, so that defines some scale E lambda, which is lambda over R3. Yeah. Lambda over R3, you expect something to happen. This is nice. We can start with Supiang-Mills theory in 3+1 dimensions and get a nice description of confinement in lower dimensions if this dream worked. Didn't quite, but so what happens in gravity? So this was in just the field theory.
You went a little bit too fast.
Okay.
How do you know that when log E gets to be lambda over R cubed, something happens? I know eventually it goes to order 1, but how do you know?
I know as well as anyone. I don't know.
It doesn't follow from the equation.
Well, I think we expect pure Yang-Mills theory in 2+1 dimensions to confine. And you know, this is as good a criterion as anything. Anyone get to that? I mean, it won't really matter because these are not the parameters that the gravity theory is going to tell us. It's going to be an obstruction.
Can I ask a very basic question?
Yeah.
By pure, you mean there is no matter field?
Yeah.
But you get all matter field only by some material, everything is gapped out?
Well, yeah. So I had to worry about the fermions. The bosons.
Okay, next talk. Okay.
There's also another boson for the gauge field, but I think that gets a mass too. It's a boson. In particular, it seems like this. It's weak coupling at least. This scale, the mass of this fermion, is actually much higher than this. So you know, the mass of mx is here. So you know, you can forget about it here. Okay, good. Okay, so now we want to do this in ADS-CFT. So basically the idea is to take n equals, the dual of n equals 4 to the Yang-Mills theory, which it's good enough just to look at the ADS-5, and at the boundary compactify the x3 direction. So basically, I want to look for, let's say, a solution to Einstein gravity plus negative cc in 5 dimensions, where x3 is identified with x3 plus r3. And there is a solution which does this. There's actually 2 solutions, but I'll tell you now that this is the lowest energy solution. It's something called the ADS soliton. It has the following metric. It's going to look very familiar, I think. Maybe not from this lecture. So notice I still have 2 plus 1 dimensional Lorentz invariants. Okay. But the x3 direction is now different. This f of r is 1 minus r0 over r4. So a picture of this geometry is as follows. This is still the radial direction, so r is in this direction. This is r goes to infinity. Basically, everything, the geometry ends at r naught. In the other direction, still draw it. There's still this sort of ADS, or this ADS-like solution, where these directions are the t, x1, x2, and this is still the radial direction. So this is just one way of picturing the geometry. So importantly, this is the x3 direction, the x3 is identified with x3 plus ry. Because of this, it can pinch off smoothly. It ending smoothly gives you a condition on the periodicity of this circle in terms of this r naught. This turns out to be something like this, up to vectors of 2 pi, I think. L is my ADS radius. So this is a picture of this geometry. So some comments about that. So. For one, it's actually should be a solution that you've seen before. The double weak rotation of the ADS black hole. So basically, I've switched the role of T and X3 and changed the sign. So something like T goes to I X3, and X3 goes to I T. And once I do that, I get the ADS black hole. In particular, this kind of pinching off is something that maybe John talked about in Euclidean time, where the periodicity here is then related to the 1 over the temperature. But this is a valid solution independent of that, so we can use it. So the consequence of this sort of minimum radius of r being bigger than or equal to r naught is that now the spectrum is gapped. So what is the meaning of that? If I look at any fields in this spacetime, the only fields that are allowed are sort of harmonics. So this is basically a box, and quantum mechanics in a box gives you a series of harmonics, something like this. And each of these modes corresponds to some mass mode, and the spectrum will look like just a relativistic spectrum like this, where this is M1 squared, squared, so forth. And the order of the gap is like 1 over this r naught. Goes like r naught, which goes like 1 over r. Okay. So this is why this kind of didn't really work, because it seems like the mass gap, which might be related to the confinement scale, is the same as the sort of the KK modes on the R3. So somehow we haven't managed to separate, like in this example, we separated these sort of scalar fields which we gapped out from the dynamics of pure Yang-Mills theory. Here we haven't managed to do that. And roughly speaking, the picture is that because now lambda is much bigger than one to begin with, as soon as you put it on a circle, you know, it's going to confine. There's going to be no perturbative regime in there. So you can't separate these scales.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, is there some understanding from the boundary theory about how does confinement matter?
From here?
In this case.
Well, I don't know. How does it? I guess you can argue from the lattice, these kind of things, right?
No, how can you argue from the lattice?
What? That there's confinement on the lattice? D1 brains and sort of two brains, okay.
Actually, this example is just one named strings, right?
Sure, but the monopole is D1 brains around the circle.
Well, okay. But
then, yeah. I probably shouldn't be talking about it. There might be something there, yeah. Yes, that's right. I think that,
there's a condensation of like F1 strings, if you like. If you had not thought of the Solitons solution in the first place, you would have found that the
Yes
is unstable.
Unstable is very, very, yeah.
Not monopoles.
It's not monopoles, yeah.
Most lines or something, yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's definitely order parameter for this.
And is there something
to do
with Chico's
plan? So you start with five-dimensional Sibelius Mills theory, do the same story, and then I actually know the answer to that question. You can compute I know what a monopole operator is, and you can compute the two-point function of that, or
But why are we starting in one higher dimension? I mean, and compactifying. Because you want a very long confinement scale or something? Is that
going? Why don't I just do what?
You're ending on 2 plus 1.
Yeah.
I can find that I want to begin 2 plus 1.
To begin with?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are examples of that. This is just sort of the simplest.
I think it's to resolve this problem we started with originally, that because space is ending, you introduce this extra dimension that allows it to sort of cap off smoothly. And from a lower dimensional point of view, it's going to look like some scalar field diverges or something at the endpoint, because space can't just end. I mean, it's going to be a singular where it ends. But if you have an extra dimension, that can smoothly shrink to zero, and space, like the end of a cigar, space can sort of cap off. So that there will be, you could just, in the bulk, reduce on this circle and you get a description in one lower dimension. But if you look like that plot on the plot most on the left, where there'd be some scalar field that would just diverge at the endpoint. It just looks smoother. Sometimes it looks smoother.
I mean, 3 plus 1 is better. I mean, is that what you're saying as far as...
I said the extra dimension allows you to geometrically the space to end in a geometrically smooth way, because you have a circle that you just, just slowly caps off, like the origin of coordinates in so in this higher dimension, the end, the space doesn't really have an end. It's like the center of, it's like the origin of spherical coordinates or something.
You're saying this is just the simplest toy model we got. In fact, the extra sphere in that dimension can also smoothly cap off in a similar way.
It's about, you need at least one extra dimension to have it end smoothly, otherwise the space would just have a boundary.
I see, so if you want to get to find the 3+1, you'd have to go to 4+1.
If you want to have a nice geometric picture.
You just include the rest of the 10 dimensions, that those can cap off.
Yeah.
The S5 is always there, or something like it. And then what's going on usually is that caps off.
So what is the answer to Matthew's question? Could somebody just go and prove confinement in 3+1?
No, it doesn't work easy, because of this problem where you can't separate the scales between it basically it's kind of a high dimensional theory.
So the dimension is crucial here, the fact that it's 2+1. And the S5.
Yeah.
Because you won't get a solution to the Einstein's equation if you go to one high dimension or what?
It's crucial.
If one were to just sort of naively repeat everything in one high dimension.
I think like the way that I've set it up with weak coupling, in principle this is a perfectly good way to look at confinement. We're going on one higher dimension and then letting it go to strong coupling. But the problem is, at strong coupling you can't separate these two scales. So if you could somehow understand string theory in intermediate scales, then you might be able to solve this problem.
But I thought you proved that there's confinement in 2+1 dimension, right?
No, I didn't.
So maybe, could let me ask a much more mundane question.
Okay.
What is the reference to Witten's paper? What year?
98.
98?
Yeah.
March
of
98. 98?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what did you prove then?
I didn't prove anything. I've heard this theory, which is sort of it's strong coupling confinement, but it's not pure Yang-Nielsen. I think I'll stop there.